Nick Buxton, welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me on.
Nick Buxton is a political activist and writer, works to support an activist labor scholar communities for the Transnational Institute. He especially works on climate change, militarism, and economic justice. He's co-editor of the book, The Secure and the Dispossessed, How the Military and Corporations Are Working to Shape a Climate-Changed World. Nick, your book is wonderful. We'll be getting it to our listeners as a premium for supporting KABU. But for me, your title actually doesn't capture the insights and depth and the inspiration of the book. So, Nick, tell us about your book and why you wrote it. And then later we can discuss the final chapters and how and why we can save the planet and ourselves. Tell us about your book.
Well, the book, kind of the genesis of the book came when I attended the UN climate negotiations in 2009 in Copenhagen. And there was a lot of expectation. In fact, the summit was called dubbed Copenhagen rather than Copenhagen, because there was a real sense that finally the global community understood the problem and that we could get real action to tackle climate change. But while I was in the negotiations, I was actually working with the Bolivian government at the time. I could see that behind the scenes, or despite all the fine talk, there was a clear attempt not to act, to commit to do nothing. And just seeing that play out, it made me realize, well, there's no shortage of analysis and understanding here, but there is a real political will to do as little as possible. So what are they actually going to plan to do when climate change impacts unfold? Because we didn't get the deniers who say this wasn't a problem. You had just deniers in terms of actually willing to take action. And as I start to look to that, I talk into kind of civil liberties and also state security analysts, I realized that actually there are two real groups who are looking long-term to think, how do we deal with climate change? One of them is the military, because they do long-term planning, and they've been producing military security plans for the impacts of climate change since the beginning of the millennium. And the other were corporations. Some of the biggest corporations have future scenarios teams. So I thought it's really important that we actually look at what they're planning to do, and are their plans for dealing with the consequences of climate change ones that we would support? How would they play out? And so that's really how the book came about. And as we started to look at it, we started to see that really what was coming through in all the language was around security, that we're going to be in a climate insecure world and we're going to need security to defend ourselves. So from a national security point of view, particularly from the U.S. military, which is defending in the end, a huge empire of military bases, of control of supply chains and so on. This was about how do we ensure that that flow of capital and commerce keeps flowing, flow of oil keeps flowing. And from a corporate point of view, it was like, how do we minimize risk to our global supply chains and protect ourselves from the consequences of climate change? But really what was never being asked in all of these strategies is security for whom? And that's really where the title comes about, is we talk about a small number of people made secure and a large number of people being dispossessed.
The corporations, just very briefly, they also have an interest in profiting from climate change, right? Their executives stay in power in the company by, in fact, increasing shareholder value. And that's their first and major priority. And basically, it's their only priority. And climate change is a challenge for them. And for them, they want to get on the right side of it and sell products and, in fact, profit from it. You look at that in the book as well.
Yeah, that's totally right. I think one is managing risk, and the other thing is corporation actually by law has to kind of maximize profit for its shareholders. So it's always looking to expand. And there's various options to do that. And one of them is manipulating scarcity, because where you have scarcity, you also have profits because prices go up. And so we see that particularly in areas that were of our concern to us as we looked at it, was in food and water. The actual financialization of these sectors has boomed massively. And a lot of it's around speculation of future crises on food and water. And so you have a lot of companies both speculating on that, but also investing in the sector, buying up water rights. So T-Bone Pickens back in Texas is buying up huge amounts of water rights right across the South, which is going to be one of the most affected by climate change in terms of, you can see climate models, you're going to have water scarcity. So you're getting this big buy-up of water rights. Here in California, the private fire industry, firefighting industry, is already looking to see how they can boom and expand, as we know that fires are going to increase. So there's always going to be these corporate players who are looking like, how do we actually turn what is a crisis to some into a profit opportunity for ourselves?
Right, and they also do all this greenwashing. I've been watching a few sports shows over the weekend, and what I got is greenwashing. All the oil companies are touting their green energy research, blah, blah. It's really preposterous. Nick, earlier you discussed the security and how corporate security and the military, who see security as containing the poor and the vulnerable and maintaining the U.S. military and economic domination of the world, and they look at climate change in that lens. So what are the consequences of that?
Well, I think we can see some of the consequences playing out already in terms of, and particularly you can see this, it's still a complex link, but around migration. In Europe, parts of North Africa are very much affected by climate change, and that's adding to a whole situation of where people have been forced to migrate. And Europe effectively uses the Mediterranean Sea as the dead zone. There's no safe way to get to Europe, so many people die just trying to cross the Mediterranean. And so we've already got a very inhumane situation here. And of course, in the U.S., similarly, it's many people die crossing not the sea, but the desert. So there is already evidence that that's starting to play out in terms of migration. And if you go for a militarized solution, which is very much the kind of Trump mindset, then it's about building higher walls. It's not about protecting people or looking out for the vulnerable. It's about kind of building higher walls against the consequences. And that's very much what you can see throughout that. And what Trump has in common with the military is this idea that we can just build barriers against the poor, against the vulnerable, and protect ourselves. And so you see that playing out. And so in a lot of the military strategies as well, they look at different parts of the region. It's like, how do we protect the shipping routes? How do we ensure that they're not overwhelmed in social insecurity and instability that erupts? And very little about how do we actually protect against this in the first place. It's important to remember that the military is actually the single largest user of petroleum in the world, the single largest organizational user, more than the entire country of Iceland.
Why don't you fairly briefly talk about how disastrous that is, both morally and in terms of security, of this sort of containment policy, and which is really sort of slow genocide?
I think it is already. This is really, if we go to a world which is about a small number of people secure and dispossessed, it's kind of going back to a medieval siege mentality where you build your castle and to hell with everyone outside the castle. But I really believe that that kind of undoes something in our humanity, and that actually real security comes from mutuality and support. And just to give you a brief story that I think kind of tells that story is, in Hurricane Sandy, when that barreled into New York and flooded into Manhattan, closing down subways and public hospitals, there was one building left alight, and it's a kind of dramatic shot of Manhattan that evening, and it's Goldman Sachs. And of course, they'd been bailed out a couple of years earlier, but they had the resources to build a huge sandbag wall to keep a massive generator running. But meanwhile, the public hospitals are closed down. So you have the public area basically dispossessed, and the private secure. But what was really important there was actually what happened in response was that the Occupy movements that had been so powerful in a couple of years before just got together and organized. And at one point, they had 60,000 volunteers responding to that hurricane. So it showed that actually when people get together, we can have a much better situation of real security for everyone. And they mobilized right across the city, and getting clothes, accommodation, shelter, food to those who needed it, setting up micro generators and so on. So that's the kind of response that I see that we need to respond to the climate crisis, not the one that just defends a few.
Right, and that it can be done. Nick Buxton, we just discussed corporate and military responses to climate change. Basically, it's let the poor die, but don't allow them to interfere with our comfortable life or our income streams. Nick Buxton explained why that won't work, how morally disastrous it is for the society, and also because the poor are not going to just die slowly and miserably. They're going to create a world of enormous dispossession and anger and military threats. But it does not end there. The last several chapters of your book, I thought the Secure and the Dispossessed, didn't work as a title, actually, because the book is so rich, in fact, in outlining and discussing the alternatives. Why don't you talk about that, the technical alternatives as well as the organizational alternatives and the human motivation and desire to, in fact, mobilize to adopt those alternatives versus our corporations and military?
One of the things we asked each, because it was a few people, experts in different areas, that we asked to look at how this security of food, water, and energy was playing out. In terms of kind of corporate military plans. And then, but what are communities trying to do to actually put forward alternatives? Because it's a reality that climate change is going to pose really unprecedented challenges to our food, water, and energy system. And the question is, what are we going to do about it? How do we cope with, for example, in food areas, potential crop decline in parts of the world, water decline in others, and floods in other regions? How do we make a more robust food and water and energy system? And what's interesting is that what really came out is that some of the things which will actually stop climate change, stop worsening climate change, are also some of the solutions in terms of building resilient systems. So if you look at food, for example, agro-industry, which depends on kind of monocrops, large use of pesticides and chemical fertilizers, and very concentration of control in a few hands, are actually much more vulnerable to some of the climate changes than a more diverse, locally controlled and robust agroecological system. You see that actually in places where hurricanes or extreme weather events have happened. So, for example, when some hurricanes hit into Central America about 10 years ago, they looked at actually the ones that most quickly recovered in terms of rice plantations and so on. And they discovered it actually was the ones practicing agroecology that were able to kind of bounce back much more quickly than the ones dependent on plantations and monocrops. So in that, you could start to see that actually an agroecological system, which is much more beneficial environmentally, is also going to be much more beneficial socially. And you see that play out in so many different areas. So in terms of energy, if you have one private corporation controlling huge amounts of energy generated from a coal power station, that's much more vulnerable in times of instability than actually more local, decentralized systems. In Nepal, when they had a huge earthquake, they had in the previous 10 years moved from a dependence on a few massive dams to a much more micro energy scheme. And they were able to recover really remarkably quickly. In disasters, suddenly you find that houses with solar panels are able to keep functioning even while the rest of the national grid is down. There's actually a lot of hope that comes out of the stuff that many people in Portland and so on are working on. It's actually, this is not just about providing a solution to stop the climate change worsening. It's also about how we adapt in a socially and environmentally way.
Nick Buxton, we're going to have to end. Let's talk about this again, all the ways in which we not only adapt, but we mobilize and, in fact, transform our energy and food systems. And it all can really be done quickly with local labor and good jobs, employing everybody and sharing the bounty of the earth in sustainable ways. Nick, thanks so much for talking to us. Your book is really wonderful. It's a premium today on our membership drive.